As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is a joy. Not that it's Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group. I'm going to read you a single sentence from December of this year. If Putin doesn't get concessions from the U.S.-led West, he is likely to act. One of the top risks for Dr. Bremmer and his Eurasia Group, and he joins us here this morning. Ian, I want to frame forward with you. I want to get without the breaking news that you've been on all weekend. The end of the free market. One of your books talks about that adjustment from free market to some form of new capitalism. What does President Putin or whoever's after Putin, what does their free market, what does their business structure, what does their command economy look like in 2 or 3 years?
Well, it's not autarkic. We talk about Putin as if he's a global pariah. That's of course not true because it's a G0 world. You can't make someone a global pariah, but he is a pariah in terms of the advanced industrial economies of the world, the G7 as it were. So what does that mean? Well, when you have the Chinese government saying that the relationship with Russia is like a rock, that means that you're going to see far more integration of Russia into the Chinese economic network, both in terms of the technology that supports the military industrial complex for Russia, the financial transactions that allow them to function as an advanced economy, and of course also the energy flows and infrastructure that will need to be built, not just in terms of oil production and export, but also eventually for gas that'll be moving towards China too. Russia will also be working with a lot of other developing countries around the world, the Gulf states, India, Brazil.
Okay.
China is going to be absolutely critical for the Russians.
Ian, how do we adapt? How do we move from 2008 in Bucharest, NATO, where Gates and Rice begged the United States to not sell democracy to the far east of Europe? How do we adapt to a new regime where just maybe possibly we can't sell democracy 24/7?
Yeah, the fact that the American model of democracy is seen by China as past its sell date and they're going to be the largest economy in the world means that we're in a hybrid system. It's competitive. The big question I have here is not about the tilt of Russia, because Russia, of course, we've been steadily losing for decades now. It's rather whether or not new technologies, which are top down, the data and surveillance economy, actually facilitates authoritarian consolidation and also undermines civil society in ways that can't be redressed. Back in 2008, technology was something we thought of as supporting democracy and undermining authoritarian states. Think about how it was the Soviet Union collapsed. Think about the Arab Spring and the colored revolutions. Well, those are all quaint and in the back view mirror right now. Instead, technology is what allows the Chinese to repress a million Uyghurs, and it doesn't lead to any demonstrations on the ground. Why? Because they can monitor and police the behavior of every single citizen. If the Russians can do that, if other smaller economies can do that, that's a big challenge to American democracy.
Ian, a lot of people right now are hoping for the bandwidth to worry about selling democracy. Right now, people are worried about selling wheat. They are worried about selling nickel and aluminum and corn and soybean oil. And what we are seeing right now is China coming out over the weekend and saying that domesticizing food production is an issue of national security. We have heard from the U.S. supply chain security is a national security security issue. How much are we seeing a pivot point moving to the mass deglobalization of our economy?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you brought up grain in particular. When you have the largest grain producer in the world invading the fifth largest grain producer in the world, one would think you're going to have big food problems. And certainly coming off the pandemic, where extreme poverty, after decreasing for decades, is going up, in the next 12 months, this is going to be absolutely critical. And you're going to see a spike in starvation around the world. Yes, in Afghanistan, but also across sub-Saharan Africa. And when you have pigs in Europe and the United States fighting for grain supply that will allow wealthy people in the world to eat the meat that they want, competing with people in the poorest countries in the world that can't buy that grain for themselves, you can see that the globalization of the world that had been leading to an increased global middle class is now unwinding, especially on the back of this crisis, which, frankly, I mean, the Russia-Ukraine invasion is going to be worse for global poverty, in my view, when all is said and done, than the pandemic has been.
Ian, that's a pretty dramatic statement. How will this conflict rearrange the economic outlook as we know it?
It's going to increase inequality because, you know, when you have massive supply chain challenges and when you have energy price spikes, it doesn't affect nearly as much the wealthy around the world who have the ability to move their assets. They have the ability to change their lives. Who gets really stuffed? The advanced economies can do more even to help support their poor and middle income economies. But the emerging markets have vastly more debt on their books after the last 2 years of crisis and now don't have any more flexibility to help their populations. But this is a massive shock to their imports coming down the pipe. Okay, not for the major commodity producers who benefit for higher prices, but if you're on the other side of that trade, you're going to be hurt dramatically coming out of this.
And Dr. Bremer, let's steal something from Fareed Zakaria here, and let's talk about not the post-American world, but the post-Putin world. I read a lot this weekend on Mr. Putin's inner circle, his defense minister who never served as a professional army guy, etc. What does the post-Putin world look like for Russia?
Well, we'd have no idea if it's going to be in 20 years or in 20 days. It's important to recognize that the likelihood of removing Putin from power is extremely low until the moment that it happens. And so it's not very useful to speculate on when it could happen, but it's important to understand that the pressure is there. And of course, that leads to more erratic behavior domestically for Putin himself, who in the last week has been taking all sorts of measures to create a North Korea-style police state that just doesn't work well for a country of relatively educated 150 million digitally literate Russians. And, you know, it's true that the average Russian believes what the Russian state media is putting out, but a lot of urban younger Russians do not. And the 10,000 Russians that have already been arrested for nonviolent protests against the war, as the economy starts to literally implode in the coming days, and you don't find goods on shelves, and you have to ration, and people don't get their wages, some of those are going to turn violent, and the Russians are going to repress it. So we have to at least consider that, you know, one of the only ways this potentially gets resolved in the near term is if you have a dramatic discontinuity in Russia itself. And that's a very hard thing to plan for in a country with 5,000 nuclear weapons.
Ian, thank you. As always, sir, Ian Bremer there of Eurasia Group.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Let's look at the equity markets now. A briefing with Lori Calvesina, head of U.S. equity strategy at RBC Capital Markets. Lori, I want to rip up the script here. You have the advantage of one H. Croft. She is absolutely exquisite on commodities. How are you folding the analysis of Halima Croft into your equity work?
All right. Well, thanks for having me, as always. And look, I am very fortunate to be working with Halima these days. And you know the drill, Tom. In December, they start trotting out all the strategists to do panels. And I was fortunate to be on a number of these with Halima. And she had been warning us that there was going to be a problem with Russia and Ukraine to start the year. You know, frankly, I think a lot of market participants were not listening to her. And it's not that we necessarily grasped how bad this was going to be in the moment, but we did have an inkling that this was coming. So as I've been able to operate through this environment, I feel fortunate that, you know, I have not necessarily been as reactive to the news as some other market participants.
And how have you changed? I don't mean we're just short on time, yeah. Lori. How have you changed your allocation given the outfrontedness you got with Halima Croft?
Well, look, we stuck with our energy overweight, even though we were getting a little bit nervous, frankly, on how bullish everybody had become. So we did stick with that. That's been fortunate. It's been one of the best performing sectors to start the year. We've also been talking about how we expected the market to sort of pivot back towards growth stocks later this year. And one of the reasons for that is we thought economic growth expectations were going to start focusing on a return to trend. We thought that would happen in 2023. I think this crisis raises the risk that we bring that economic projection that reining in of economic expectations in a little bit earlier than anticipated. Secular growth stocks tend to do well when the economy is cool. So that has helped us sort of stay very steady in some of those sector allocations we had to start the year.
Lori, is this a buyable dip?
I don't know if you necessarily want to buy it today. And the framework we've used is that we view this as a growth scare, something that doesn't necessarily push us into a recession, but makes everyone feel like we're going to hit one. And if you look at growth scare pricing, it could take the S&P 500 down to around 3,900 in the short term. Growth scares tend to see markets fall 14 to 20% peak to trough. We simply haven't done that yet, despite how terrible the sentiment's been.
Lori, you said that it can make everyone feel like we're going to into a recession, even though we're not. And that's been sort of the tipping point of a lot of strategists, whether this is or isn't a recessionary event. What are you looking at for the resilience that could potentially tip over should the commodity surge continue?
So look, I think, you know, maybe the silver lining of coming out of this pandemic, and I use that in quotes with a bit of irony, but we've all got this arsenal of high frequency economic barometers that we've been living and breathing for the last couple years because of COVID. And I'm keeping a very close eye on those right now. We're still seeing improving trends in open table dining, flying, return to work is still in the process of recovering and has a way to go. But none of these are showing any signs of slowing down right now, Lisa. So I think we have to keep an eye on the resiliency of the consumer in here and whether or not that holds up.
Lori, this question might sound counterintuitive at first approach. I just wonder how nuanced this might be. Is there a point where crude goes so high that energy equities stop going higher with it?
I think it's a point at which the market starts to sense out demand destruction. And I don't think there are any easy answers to that question in terms of where that exact level is. Frankly, we would have thought we would have already seen it by now. I think that we have to sort of counterbalance the oil price impact with the psychological impact of reopening and many consumers very eager to get back to their lives. We're seeing that resilience. We're seeing that eagerness to get back to normal dominating in the data right now. There will eventually probably be a point at which that won't hold up. But all I can tell you today, John, is we haven't hit it yet.
Lori, thank you. Lori Calvesina of RBC Capital Markets. Wonderful as always.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
John, what's so important here in this anticipated interview is it is 8,004 miles from Midland, Texas to Riyadh, and that is a world apart of global oil economics and the marginal economics of getting the marginal barrel out of the ground to be marginally refined. John, we can speak with Paul Sankey of Sankey Research.
We'll catch up with Paul Sankey right now. Paul, let's start right here. Often these conversations, and sometimes it's our fault, Sometimes it's the fault of the people we speak to. We talk as if there is this special tap down in Texas that you can just turn, go down there and just turn, and all of a sudden crude output is up. Talk to us about how difficult that effort is, if we even tried to.
Well, I mean, it's even basic labor, but, you know, then if you get into engineers and just the ability to add capacity is being wildly exaggerated here simply because there aren't the people. And as Thomas referenced, Midland is kind of in the middle of the desert. In fact, it is in the middle of the desert. And there's tremendous competition from Austin for both labor and engineers. And so just in people terms alone, for commentators to turn around and say, you know, the US E&P industry should add capacity and volume is completely misguided. I was in Midland in late December talking to the service companies, talking to Diamondback, a major E&P there. And the fact is that things are drum tight prior to this crisis. And yes, they could add on a one-year view, but there's nothing they can do this week.
Paul, they are damned if they pump. Environmentalists criticize them and investors punish them, and they're seemingly blamed if they don't. Paul, what do you make of the relationship between the administration and the oil patch in America at the moment?
I mean, absolutely appallingly badly managed because, of course, as you know, they came in with almost no oil expertise on the basis that they would change the energy system. I don't know how you can change the energy system without oil expertise. And now you're in a situation where you're talking to Venezuela, you're talking to Iran, and you're basically pretty much not talking to Texas. So it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Paul, how much could they actually, though, influence the output in Texas quickly, given the fact that there has been a lack of investment, given the fact that a lot of this has been driven not by Washington, but by a lot of the shareholders that have looked for fiscal discipline?
Well, the point that John highlighted from my research yesterday was that if they try to aggressively increase capacity now, they're simply going to compete with each other. And Tom also picked up on the point. You're just going to inflate things more because all you're going to do is take the guys from the next door rig and put them on your own rig. And the list goes on because it's not just about people. It's about steel. It's about cement. It's, well, as they would say, cement. It's even about sand, actually, at a given level. So there's just all sorts of tightness down there because we know we were in a commodity squeeze already before all this happened, which is why it's so dramatic. The answer is, you know, if you really started to reorganize towards more capacity, you would begin to see an impact towards the end of this year.
So, Paul, what could this administration do? What would you like to see them do in order to support more domestic production as opposed to going to Venezuela, as you point out?
Well, the grand scheme, as you know, is nuclear with a new grid. But of course, you know, can we do that? The utilities don't really want it. You know, the utilities have a lot of vested interest and don't get the criticism they should. Nor does Amazon get the criticism it should for, you know, the amount of oil that's used to deliver a package to everyone and return half of them. You know, all of this stuff is not really examined in the grand scheme of things. But above all, what the industry wants is consistency. So one of the latest things that we're seeing is suddenly they're saying we'll reduce the federal gasoline tax. Totally idiotic, just in terms of environmental friendliness and not encouraging efficiency. What they're saying is we'll take off the stupid mandate for ethanol, you know, being used. Mm-hmm. Again, just as the industry is moving towards major investment in renewable diesel, the administration says, actually, we might have to change this because there's a crisis. Right. It's a crisis management. And that's exactly what, you know, leads to what I call the energy regression. Mm-hmm. We're in an energy regression. We're going backwards.
Paul, let me go to the third rail, and it's not the expensive summer camp. That was a third rail this weekend. Let me go to the third rail of the Keystone Pipeline. Is it a valid economic project, and can it actually enhance United States energy independence?
Yes, I mean, it could, and absolutely more Canadian oil is an obvious outlet here to as a long-term solution, because obviously we have such a tremendous ally right there with the available oil, who, by the way, are doing a tremendous job of scope 1 and 2 emissions reductions. So yes, that shouldn't have been delayed back in 2015, which was when the Obama administration first threw a wrench in the works. Actually, the Biden administration was just bad messaging because by then the project was pretty much dead, insofar as the Biden administration canceled it as the first, literally the first thing that they did. But yeah, you could easily resuscitate mm-hmm. this stuff if you could get around the environmental opposition. Environmental opposition is local. You know, it's a problem of negotiating
right.
very specific issues. The latest one has been this Mountain Valley Pipeline, which would release more U.S. gas from the Marcellus into the general U.S. economy and to export. And that's 96 complete with $6 billion sunk. And a federal judge blocked it for crossing the Appalachian Trail. You know, stuff like that just makes no sense environmentally.
Paul Sankey, gasoline, AAA unleaded from 360 out to, I believe, 407 in seven travel days, if you will. In your head, where is the tip point on AAA unleaded where it really begins to affect our behavior?
450, so 450 nationwide, but then you add 60 cents. Well, that's the retail price, but then you have to add a dollar in New York and a dollar in California, you know, in the higher tax states. So you're going to get to 550. And by the way, that's in the post. That's going to happen because essentially the gasoline price is trailing the crude price, obviously quite severely.
So what happens when we get to 550?
Well, people change behavior quite radically because obviously there's a lot of discretion over how much you drive your car, which car you drive, whether you drive like a crazy idiot or, you know, very conservatively, whether you pump up your tires. We saw all of this in 08, Tom, and, you know, there's actually quite a significant ability to change behavior. What's interesting now is obviously that you have very low unemployment and therefore people do need to drive. And so I think the elasticity here is going to be pretty sticky, to say the least, and I think we'll get to really significantly higher gasoline prices are absolutely guaranteed.
Paul, that's the test, and I think this is really interesting for you and I to try and talk through, work out. It's an open question. In the Treasury market, when yields go higher, aggressively higher, we talk about how self-limiting a sell-off would be because it starts to bite the US economy and yields come back in. Does the same dynamic exist in the commodity market for crude? And I'm trying to work out what that might mean for, say, the likes of Oxy up more than 90%. Year to date. At what point do energy prices go too high for even energy equities to continue rallying with it?
Yeah, I mean, you get into the point of demand destruction. Obviously, Oxy was an outlier move because we now know that Warren Buffett was building a significant stake and seemed to want to do it entirely in a week. So, but generally speaking, if the market begins to believe the strip, which is now over 100 all the way down as far as the eye can see, then these things move higher, and it's really the back end of the price curve that matters, which, you know, is aggressively higher. I think because there's a total question mark over what Russia will look like in the future. I think there's two things here. Number one is that very good news this morning, Russia has softened its stance, and I think we see the markets coming back. Given that Russia is softening its stance, maybe at the point of admitting defeat here, quite possibly. That's the good news. The bad news is we may actually see Russia now permanently out of the market, for multiple years, long enough to make a difference to the strip, at which point the future strip will be at 100. And these things are hugely undervalued against that. Once you get to 130, 40, 50 on a spot basis, obviously we worry about demand destruction, and really the big question here, and you guys debate it constantly, is what will the recession look like? You know, it's not a question whether we get a recession, it's like what kind of recession are we going to get?
Paul, awesome. As always, good to catch up with you, sir. Paul Sankey.
Thanks, guys.
Of Sankey Research.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
It is our great pleasure now to introduce the former governor of the Bank of Israel, but far more than that, the Rockefeller professor at the University of Chicago just a few years ago, Jacob Frankel. It has been far too long since we've seen you working with Mr. Dimon at J.P. Morgan. He comes to us today from his Tel Aviv. Professor Frankel, let me cut to the chase. Joe Stiglitz talked about globalization and its discontents. We have globalization and Mr. Putin's discontent, or Mr. Putin's grievances. What will come after?
Well, remember, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, the entire world was excited to embrace Russia, to embrace China, to bring them into the group of nations. The G7 has become G8, the G20, WTO, the World Trade Organization, all brought them in, and both China and Russia have benefited immensely from being integrated into the world. This has been a great period, which unfortunately, during the past few years, with the emergence of the trade war, and now with the invasion of the Ukraine, has inverted it all back. Russia will end up being much poorer. They are suffering on a day in and day out. They are isolated, they are secluded financially, economically, politically. And the question now is, how will the world look like thereafter? I think that, unfortunately, to my mind, the globalization will be part of the legacy of the past. And we will now move to a new world order in which democracies of the type of the US and Europe will be on one side, and other autocratic countries mm-hmm. like China and Russia will be on the other hand.
But Jacob, how do we get to that place, considering the intertwining of the supply chains, as we've seen, that we still haven't moved away from? Even with the pandemic, a lot of companies have kept their factory footprints in China.
Indeed. They've kept them in China because it was economically warranted. And I believe that they will continue working with China. China sees what happens with Russia. So while it does not take clear sides and does not join the world in condemning what is happening in Russia, by the same token, it takes the so-called, in their language, the middle ground. So China will continue to be a partner, but it will be of a different nature, not of camaraderie, mm-hmm. but of self-interest.
Jacob Frankel, as a former governor of the Bank of Israel, a bit of a delicate question, but I will ask it of you. What is the place of Israel to negotiate some form of better place in this war in Ukraine?
Well, I believe that the place of Israel is to be wherever it is found to be useful. And in this regard, when both the U.S. and Russia and the Ukraine have approached the Prime Minister of Israel in a request to see if he can bring some common sense, even though the chances are not very high, like most cases of such negotiations, Mr. Bennett decided to jump to the water and to see if he can bring a little bit of a cohesion. But I can tell you, this is not an issue. It's a big, big issue. So even a progress of one inch is a progress.
Jacob, right now we're getting a sense that the U.S. is working on striking some sort of Iranian deal in order, a nuclear deal, in order to unleash some of the oil supplies there. I know this is a delicate issue for Israel. Is there more willingness in the nation to allow that type of deal and actually support it, given where we are in the commodity space?
Well, we are so much now in the midst of everything, and to get into the kitchen when there are important chefs in it is never a wise move to take. But what I can say is that given the situation that the U.S. is planning, and effectively so, to ban imports of oil, it will be extremely important to find other sources. And other sources can come from Saudi Arabia, can come from other places that have it. So this is, I will put it in this context. What is important, however, is not to forget that the, and this has been the position of Israel all along, that the Iranian deal, the key word is not deal, but the key word is security and safety to all concerned. And if it compromises it, then it's not a good deal. And if it does not compromise it, then it is a good deal.
Jacob Frankel, thank you so much for joining us from Tel Aviv today. Of course, former international chairman at J.P. Morgan Chase, the former governor of the Bank of Israel. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations, and subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.